My name's Jason Carty.
My name's Stephen Cockcroft.
And we're live on tape from Dublin and Belfast. Today, it's another look back on the 25th anniversary of the Beatles anthology in our season opener this year. We looked at the long and winding road, ho-ho, from 1968, when the project was first mooted, up until 1992, when it suddenly burst into a real-life thing. And today we're going to look at 1992 up until the air date, and there's still another long and winding road to go in that. Maybe it's a long and a short and winding road from 1992 onwards, Stephen.
You're really working this
metaphor.
Metaphor.
Yes,
it's taken a long time to get to this point, but we're still some distance from the finished product by May 92.
Yeah, and so what we'll kind of look at today is how, you know, it might have all seemed very planned, but, you know, there's also a couple of happy accidents that happen along the way. So if we're trying to look at a point, it's May 1992 when Apple announce officially that the band are working on a documentary. And it is still called The Long and Winding Road at this point. That's the name they use, isn't it?
Yes, I think that's the interesting thing at this point. That's still the project name, and that's been around since the early 70s.
And I think if you're a Beatles fan at that point, you know, you'll probably have known that The Long and Winding Road has an existence. So for fans at the time who might have read this, it would have flagged up to them that, oh my gosh, this is actually happening. And probably the first concrete thing that they do are the interviews get started pretty much soon afterwards.
Yes. This is a long period of working out. They start interviews. Jules Holland is initially brought in to do the interviews. Mm. So in June 1992, he's on a little tugboat in the Thames with Paul. If you remember that footage,
yes.
of Paul in the... So all of these interviews will take place over the next 2 to 3 years. Almost all of the interviews are done separately. So
yeah.
you very rarely in this project do we see all of the three Beatles together. And also there's a little bit of mix and match where you can see them, beards coming and going, hair getting shorter, grayer,
yes.
in Paul's case, less gray. When you see the finished product, you can see they sort of intercut interviews from different periods.
And it would be lovely to get maybe some raw, uncut interview footage. But it's interesting that even from the start, some of this is being done by committee. Because Jules Holland is an interesting choice. He's a friend of musicians, but he's not really David Frost when it comes to interviews.
No, I mean, I think it's, you know, with all respect to Jules, you know, his interviews on his music programs are not the highlight.
Yeah.
And he doesn't last long, to be fair.
No, he doesn't. But what I will say in Jules's defense is, you know, he hosts the show later on BBC TV, and is that there's never any anxiety in any musician who's sitting down to be interviewed by him on his show. They always know it's going to be like, oh, what did you listen to growing up? And do you like Boogie Woogie Piano? Away we go. So always quite laid back. So, you know, he was obviously a name from a shortlist that seemed to be acceptable to Paul, George and Ringo.
Yes, and this is one of the things that I think we'll come across as we talk through this project is the acceptability test that has to be passed for each of the three of them. That whoever is involved in this, there's a lot of compromises involved in putting the team together.
Yes.
And yes, you do get a sense Jules Holland was probably, you know, he's a musician's musician.
Yes.
And he was acceptable to all three.
And so these interviews, when you see the anthology, they have different backdrops. So Paul is on a boat, as you say, at one point, and another one, he's sitting in front of a very impressive stage, like in a sound check kind of zone.
Yeah.
Ringo's always sitting behind his shades. George is always in some corner of Friar Park with a moustache, without a moustache, in a jumper. And, you know, Paul knows how to be interviewed, and the others are kind of slightly, the tone is a bit off a little bit.
Paul is clearly loving
it. He's loving that it's actually happening.
Yeah, it's just the fact that it's that just comes across in every single shot. He's just thrilled to finally be doing there.
And do we know how long Jules lasts? Because is who takes over the interviews? Is it Jeff Wanford who does some of the other interviews?
I think Jeff Wanford does some. And is it Bob Smeaton, who was the series director? Is he involved as well?
I think he's certainly in the room. Yeah.
So one of the things is that you rarely see, you never see the interviewer.
You can see Jules' head on the boat.
Yeah. And that's about it. Yeah. That's, you know.
Yeah, it's very hard to see where they are. You can and occasionally you hear Jules Holland laughing in the background. So the summer of 1992, these interviews are the first kind of concrete thing that come into existence, and they're obviously still just raw footage. By the end of that year, you know, we've got to remember that Paul is still being an active musician. You know, he's you know, simultaneously finishing and teeing up his Off the Ground album, and he's going to spend 1993 on the road. Yep. But there's a big meeting at the end of the year in October at MPL, and that's who's that with?
Yes, well, this is essentially a business meeting where I think the three of them are there.
Yeah.
And one of the things that comes across, as I say, is that there's a lot of negotiation around this, not only in getting it set up, but as the project moves forward, every stage is subject to negotiation. Mm. You know, they each have their team of lawyers and helpers and PAs and managers, and all of this negotiation is going on.
And so as we go into the end of the year, Paul says, you know, oh, you know, yes, this is happening, and me and George might do a little bit of music for it.
Yeah, yeah.
And for once, there isn't a witty put down or riposte from George. George doesn't deny it.
No, I mean, George over the years has always been very quick to point out that Paul sort of drags up the possibility of Beatles reunions when he has something to sell or when he has a tour to promote. This doesn't happen here. I mean, as recently as October that year, George was still downplaying the reunion rumors. And he was asked in an interview about the Beatles getting back together again. He famously says, how many Beatles does it take to change a light bulb? Mm-hmm. The answer is four. And it's very much this idea where he's saying, you know, if John Lennon, for so long as John Lennon is still dead,
there's no
Beatles. But then Paul is sort of saying, oh, we're going to get together, we're going to write some music. Now, at this stage, it's Paul seems to be alluding to the fact that he and George are going to write some incidental music. That's how people interpret that, I think.
Yes. And so, you know, as we said, 1993 ends up being a bit of a busy year for Paul. So obviously some of those interviews in front of the stage or on the Paul World Tour,
on that tour,
that becomes, you know, Paul Is Live, you know, Off the Ground comes out at the start of the year. The Paul Is Live album comes out at the end of the year. So he's still doing his thing, and these interviews are happening in the background. And obviously they're starting to knock it into shape. But, you know, the question in 93, and I find this quite interesting, is that there's still no plan at this point to put out any of the albums or any of the, you know, like we now think of the anthology and we think of the three double CDs of music that came out at the same time. And in 1993, that wasn't really on the cards.
No, that's certainly early 93. That does not seem to be on anybody's radar.
Yeah.
They're very much focused. This is a documentary project. You know, there's footage, there's outtakes, clearly there, little bits of film and live, but actually dragging all of that out of the vault, looking at it and putting out an album is not on the radar. George Martin gave an interview in 1993 in March, and he actually says there are no usable outtakes. And the direct quote was, it's all junk. couldn't possibly release it. So he's absolutely downplaying the idea that there's anything. There's going to be no hidden gems coming out of this.
Yeah.
But what's happening at the same time is, with the rise of CDs and the ability to sort of press up or record CDs, there is a whole industry gathering pace producing bootleg material.
Well, I remember vividly 92, 93, because I was in college at the time, finding a shop in Dublin that did bootleg CDs.
Yeah.
Good old Record Collector on Wicklow Street. Don't look for it. It's not there anymore. But I remember finding bootleg CDs. Unsurpassed Masters were there, the Yellow Dog CDs. And they were prohibitively expensive.
Yes. Yes. They
were about 30 quid each, I think.
Up here they were maybe, and that's in Belfast, we had Hector's House again. Don't look for it, it's not there. Yes, the ultra rare tracks, the Unsurpassed Masters, I think they were maybe 20 quid, something like that.
So you start to see these, and you know, you'd have to be blind not to notice that there's a market for this kind of stuff.
Yes. I mean, there were, you know, the shops that I was going to, the shop that I mentioned, was full of these. They were always described as Italian imports for some reason. But they became more and more sophisticated. So, I mean, I remember the one that I most vividly recall and I still have is a collection called Artifacts, which is a long box of five CDs with very extensive notes. Came out, I think, in 1993 and really ran from 1958 to 1970. So it started with That'll Be the Day and it finished with the I Me Mine session in January 1970. And it was incredibly high quality and it was like a documentary in itself. You know, and you would get, you had the Morecambe and Wise, Moonlight Bay sketch. You had the concert in Sweden. You had outtakes from the Penny Lane and Strawberry Fields sessions. You know, the Isha demos. It was all there.
Yeah, yeah. And so somebody obviously starts to try and put two and two together to realize that there must be some way of doing an official version of getting this music out there. And so towards the end of 93, as we said, Paul is on tour and he gets a special visitor at one of his gigs in September.
He does.
Who goes to see Paul?
Well, you know, George goes to see Paul.
And he jumps up on stage and puts his arms around him.
And they have a great night and everything.
He doesn't do that.
No, he doesn't do that. He tells Paul the concert was quite good, but it was too long.
I mean, this is a recurring theme. You know, why? George, you know, just be nice.
Yeah, because it was too, he probably did Biker Like an Icon or something.
Well, he probably did. Yeah, it wasn't his best live moment, maybe.
But you know, Paul gives a little sort of interview in response to this and comments on this and refers to the fact and said, you know, I get really angry about this, but, you know, he's my buddy and we've got to kind of, because he's clearly aware he's got to stay on the right side of George. Everybody has to stay on the page.
Yes. So, and, you know, Paul really wants this to happen. And, you know, he's pushing over the line. George, as we kind of said in the first anthology episode, you know, he's got a financial reason now to buy in. He's at risk of, you know, losing an awful lot. His movie money is gone. And so he needs to, you know, bite his tongue, eat humble pie, but he's not making it easy. He's still bristling at some of this stuff that's going on. And so it's not as, you know, it could have been simple, you know, and if George had jumped up on stage in 93, that would have been a great bit of publicity to get it going, you know, and it just, it's just a pity.
It is funny that, you know, as you say, we said, George is probably the most driven in this to do this for financial reasons.
Yes.
And you would think if you were that in the hole financially, you would be playing the game.
Yes.
But clearly he knows that no matter how badly he needs this, Paul wants it.
Yes. Well, has this thing where, and you know, he said this on and off, not just in George, not just to do with anthology, but, you know, that he's this kind of self-appointed, you know, BS detector because John is not there. And I think he overeggs that pudding. I don't think John would have done some of the things that George did in that period if he'd been around.
You think?
I don't think. I mean, John would have been sardonic and mean and, you know, might have been funny and cutting. But I think maybe I'm getting the wrong end of the stick, but I think he would have been a bit more forgiving or a bit more
gracious.
Yeah. am I wrong in saying that it's not very gracious?
I think you can get the sense that George resents the fact that he has to do this.
Yeah.
You know, he's not doing this willingly or voluntarily. He's doing it because he has to. And I think there's a degree of resentment there that.
But Paul is not rubbing his face in it. Paul is kind of, you know, well, Paul kind of wants it to be, come on, gang, let's just have a, you know, good old time, you know?
But you can see that's what Paul was doing in the Let It Be session.
It's
I think Paul is being Paul. That's the point. And you can see or you can get the sense that this is just rubbing George up the wrong way.
That same month in September 93, the Red and Blue compilations come out on CD. And this is significant because it's to do with the settlement that Apple made and EMI and the Beatles made with each other at the end of the 80s, start of the 90s. And yeah. The Red and Blue album's coming out on CD on the 20th of September, 93. That's a big deal. It's the first CD release of Beatles material that's not just the main core albums, which came out in 87.
Yes.
And they're full price, double CDs. They've got the Apple logo on them, so the Apple logo returns. I remember there was big TV ads at the time.
Yeah.
Even though they were just compilations, it was a big deal.
It was a big deal because, you know, again, this is something we touched on in the compilations episode. These albums have a sort of iconic status because so many people, this is their entry point.
Yeah.
You know, from 1973, whenever they first came out, certainly they were albums that I bought very early on.
Yes.
And that kind of skewed my understanding of the Beatles because we've talked before about, you know, Revolver is not represented well. The White Album is underrepresented. So you get, but these are the entry points. So all of the people that bought them in 1973 are now buying them again on CD. And as you say, full price.
Yep.
Double CD, even though people were making the point at the time, you know, drop one track or two tracks, you could squeeze this onto a single CD.
Red would have fitted onto one CD anyway, and Blue could have done it with a one or two tracks dropped. But it's also a proof of concept. It says, look, the Beatles here and Apple, the new and improved Apple as a Beatles company, can issue material, people will buy it, and it will go into the catalogue and it'll chug along. And we're going to come back to another release in a second. But that means at the end of 93, according to Peter Doggett in his You Never Give Me Your Money book, you know, this is when Paul and George start to realise that actually there is money to be made here. And there's a business structure in place for them to be made. And so while the footage is still being put together, you know, Derek Taylor is working on a book and George Martin does start to go off to Abbey Road to see what's in the vaults.
What's in the vault,
So it starts to pick up. So this tips into 1994 and in apparently the 1st of January 1994, who enters the picture?
Mrs. Lennon.
Mrs. Lennon. Move over, Mrs. L. Yoko enters the room and Paul... Apparently, now there's the legend, and then there's the truth.
Yes, this is the other thing we have to be very aware of. There's a lot of deliberate myth making,
and it is by Paul. Yes, he's the master of PR. But the legend goes that Paul rings up Yoko and says,
"Happy New Year.
Should old acquaintance be forgot?" And all that. And, you know, this is where we get the notion that Paul sort of says, hey, is there any demos of John's knocking around?
It's like having Paul here.
But later in January, Paul inducts John into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and has a totally normal hanging out interaction with Yoko.
Yes.
Correct?
I mean, yes, you can see this. This clip is on YouTube, Paul giving the speech and there are photographs. And it's just the most excruciatingly awkward hug. You know, Yoko's there dressed in white with this sort of, you know, floppy hat. Paul is kind of very awkwardly, you know, hugging and putting his arm. It's all staged and... Yeah, there's a lot of tension there.
Well, it's, you know, January 94, Paul is kind of now in, he is tipping over into full tilt anthology mode. And if you think of Paul's 90s, he only puts out two studio albums, proper studio albums during that time, Off the Ground and Flaming Pie at either end of the decade. You know, he does dedicate himself full tilt to the anthology in the middle. And although he's working on solo stuff in the background and putting Flaming Pie together, you know, he has agreed with EMI to kind of park that and focus on getting stuff out in terms of the Beatles. So he is, you know, he's doing the PR thing, you know?
He's the main cheerleader for this project.
Yeah.
I mean, and almost, well, one, self-appointed, but two, absolutely by default. You know, George isn't going to do this.
Yeah.
And Ringo, you get the sense that he's there in the background. Fulfilling that role that Ringo always seems to fulfill, which is a sort of stabilizing influence. You know, again, we'll come on to this when you see some of the interactions between all three of them on camera.
So they have this Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction, and apparently Paul was supposed to be inducted the following year, and that doesn't happen.
That doesn't happen. That does not happen.
Which kind of explains when Paul does get inducted, I can't remember which year that was. It was early 2000s, I think. Stella McCartney's wearing a t-shirt that says "About Effing Time" on it during the ceremony. Yes. But Paul is the cheerleader. And so this is where we start to learn, i.e. the general public, that he gets the demo tapes from Yoko.
So Paul announces, you know, that the three Beatles will record together using these demo tapes.
Yes.
So that becomes an announcement, but which is odd because there had already been a story in the press that the Beatles had recorded together. So Goldmine magazine in earlier prior to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction, I think, had reported that there'd been a Beatles recording session in August the previous year, which was a complete lie or complete untruth.
But then again, people did know that the Long and Winding Road project was a thing.
Yes.
So they knew that this was possibly a reality.
Yes, on the cards. The two comments that I made a note of are, again, the Times, that's the London Times, says the Beatles have had their day. You know, they're not overly enthusiastic. And then the font of all musical knowledge, Kiss FM, say the Beatles don't mean anything to young people today.
That's very sad. And yet here we are, Stephen, two young people with a podcast.
Yes, with a podcast.
It's amazing. But, you know, it's also nice to know that Yoko was the person who got the Beatles back together.
Yes. Pete Doggett makes the point that she recognizes that she is in a position to facilitate this sort of virtual reunion, having for years been the one that, was blamed for their breakup. But she also, I mean, the shades of George there as well. But she says, well, after all, John was the band leader, you know. So after all, it was my late husband's band, so I should really facilitate it. So again, poor Paul is coming under this pressure from everyone is kind of poking him with a stick.
He's just biting his lip. They're like, now's our chance.
Yeah.
And so Paul apparently goes to the Dakota the day after the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, which must have been strange for him, and meets with Yoko and Sean and basically offers her a veto, apparently.
Yes. I mean, this is fascinating to me. One, that Sean is there. He is part of this. So Yoko is kind of bringing him into this.
Yeah.
Paul says, you know, I checked it out with Sean because I didn't want him to feel awkward. And Sean says, well, it'll be weird hearing a dead guy on vocals, but, you know, give it a try, is the direct quote that Paul... And that again, that's a peculiar... It seems to me reaction.
Yes.
To have. But yes, he basically says to Yoko, or he says he said to Yoko, you know, if we don't like it, we won't
put it out.
And similarly, he seems to have said, if you don't like it, we won't put it out.
Yeah, which was weird, but I don't think that was ever going to be a reality. And so the demos he gets are Free as a Bird, Grow Old With Me, Real Love, and Now and Then. They're she gives him four songs. And what's funny is, and maybe it's not funny because, you know, we pay attention to this stuff. They don't pay attention to it. They didn't really know that these songs were out and in the ether already.
Absolutely bizarre.
Mm. Like even I, when I've heard Real Love was announced, I think in 94 or 95, I was like, oh, that's the song from the Imagine soundtrack in 88.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. I mean, I think it's a different version of the song.
Demo. That's the guitar version, but it's still the same tune and melody. Still,
and Grow Old With Me is on Milk and Honey.
Mm.
It is bizarre that they don't know this. But again, more recently, Ringo recorded Grow Old With Me, and he made the point, oh, I never realized that John wrote this song for me.
Yeah.
I don't know. I've heard some of those Dakota demos, and you can hear John, life begins at 40. This one's for Ringo. Nobody told me, oh, this would be great for Ringo. I was never aware of that story.
Now, the truth is, we talk about Paul's, you know, burnishing the myth of I rang Yoko up and we buried the hatchet. It seems that this goes back to 1991, is it? The demo idea.
Yes, so Yoko again is makes it clear that the people that originally approached her were George and Neil Aspinall,
yeah.
And this was back in 1991. They were floating this idea, and again, if you think about where we got to in the last episode, this is right back at the origins of the project. So, what they had in mind at that time, it's hard to say, but yes, she makes it very clear. Happened to be convenient to hand these over to Paul at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, but it was really Neil and George that they initiated.
Yeah, that's interesting that Neil and George are kind of running that. Now, George, you know, there's a similar idea that George was involved in at the time. Now, this is a rumor.
This is
kind of something I wasn't really aware of until you told me about it.
Yeah, this is a rumor that's been circulating that after Roy Orbison passed away in the Traveling Wilburys, that they were looking for a replacement. And certainly I remember at the time, there was talk about Del Shannon as a possible replacement. Roger McGuinn, his name was being mentioned in the music papers. But there is a rumor that George approached the estate of Elvis Presley and said, you know, would you have a song or would you have something unreleased, a vocal track that we could take and work on for use on the second Traveling Wilburys album? Now, I have no idea whether this is accurate or not. You see it coming up on the internet from time to time, but it could very well be just one of those myths that feeds itself.
But it does seem, you know, interesting, this sort of notion of Aaron Wilbury, you know? And you know, there has been precedent for, you know, even going back to Buddy Holly's posthumous records of people going in and recording on them and turning them into hits, you know?
Yes, and I mean, we've been through this with Hendrix.
Yeah.
And then, you know, Nat King Cole recording with his daughter and...
yes, that's right, yeah.
Paul was actually asked at one point if he would duet with Elvis on a song, you know, posthumously. And he said, no, you know, I think that would be distasteful. I don't think that would be, you know, we didn't sing together when he was alive. It's not as if we had a partnership, you know.
And there's two other projects I can remember from the 90s, which was in 91, there was a Thin Lizzy single, Dedication, which they recorded over a fill-in, a backing track. And then when Anthology eventually comes out, it kind of clashes with the Queen album, Made in Heaven, which is a big posthumous Freddie Mercury album. So this notion of adding, you know, it's not totally new, but the Beatles were obviously trying to marry some very old technology with some new recording. So who could you call for a situation like that?
You a man of distinction that you wouldn't often find.
The man behind the shades, behind the shades.
Behind the shades, behind the shades, behind the beard.
And we're talking about, say his name, Stephen.
Jeff Lynne. I can see you getting excited and you're shuffling in your seat.
Oh, I'm getting all excited. Jeff Lynne. Here comes Jeff Lynne to try and solve the big quandary of how to turn the raw material of John's demo tapes into fantastic. I mean, like, who better to make a Beatles record than Jeff Lynne himself? Well, he's made so many great Beatles records.
Yeah, you really wanting me to engage in this conversation with that? Yes. It could only be Jeff Lynne. And the reason it could only be Jeff Lynne is that George said it can only be Jeff Lynne.
Yeah. it is. Yeah. And, you know, it's a contentious issue because some people are allergic to Jeff Lynne and
some people
in the room, well, in the virtual room here. But also, I personally remember, you know, when he was announced as the producer, that, you know, you did think, oh, it's going to sound, you know, it's going to have a bit of that, you know, it's going to come from that same DNA.
Yeah, it's going to sound like it was made in 1978.
And what's wrong with that? not in a good way, not in a undertones way.
No.
So Jeff is the de facto producer, and like kids in a schoolyard, Paul chooses Jeff Emmerich as engineer.
Yes.
One each at a time. And Jeff has form, obviously, he's worked with George, he's worked with Ringo.
Yes.
Jeff Lynne, this is.
Yes, he'd worked with Ringo on Time Takes Time in 1992. So supposedly George this is an ultimatum. You know, this is an absolute condition that George lays down. And Ringo endorses that. So Paul has to accept that. But as you say, then he goes with Jeff Emmerich, and, you know, he and George don't have the best relationship. So it's this compromise. And again, you get the sense that Ringo is holding the balance.
He's the lukewarm water.
Yes.
Just do lots of Spinal Tap references this week. But the recording site is interesting, that they choose Paul's studio, which is what's it called, Hog Hill, which is a converted windmill, because George does have a functioning studio in Friar Park as well. He's got FP Shot.
He does. And again, you get the sense this is part of the compromise. Well, if you're getting the producer, I'll get the engineer in the studio.
Yeah. Yeah. You
know? So it's a trade-off.
And so the recording proceeds for February 1994, and February 11th seems to be the first day of recording. And that kind of makes the whole thing look a bit more of a lie, the whole story of January, that, you know, Jeff Lynne suddenly rocks up on the 11th of February, a few weeks after the cassettes have been handed over. This is obviously something that's been in process for a while.
It's really hard to credit that they just, you know, Paul got off the plane, drives straight to Jeff's house, gives him the cassettes, and Jeff spends a week beavering away, cleaning up the tapes and getting clicks and hums off it. I mean, that doesn't kind of stack up. And then 2 or 3 weeks later, they're in a studio recording.
Yeah, just ready to go. Yeah. And Free as a Bird is the one that gets attacked first. And it's interesting, you know, Jeff has spoken in his Mr. Blue Sky documentary, and Paul does a great interview on that as well, about the whole process and how, you know, it had to be sped up and slowed down. And there's a lot about this. There's a lot about Anthology generally that speaks to, it's right on the cusp of the internet world, the Anthology project. It's one of the reasons why the timing of it is so good, because we're pre-YouTube, we're pre-file sharing. You know, if Jeff was working on this, you know, nowadays you wouldn't think twice about digitally sending it across to Jeff's house in LA and then firing it back.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
You know, we're currently working in a time where, you know, bands are making albums from different locations in the world due to lockdowns of various kinds. But all of this, you know, the whole Beatles Anthology project is kind of the last gasp of that kind of pre-internet world.
Yes. And the other aspect of that is, these days you would probably be aware of precisely what was happening, because Peter would be, someone would be, you know, George would be using his Instagram account to put it up, or Ringo would be tweeting pictures of what was happening in the studio. So I remember at the time knowing vaguely that the project was happening.
Yes.
But maybe my sort of tuning into the Beatles was not fully functioning at the time. I was moving on to other things, but I wasn't. You know, you couldn't follow this in real time. You were getting little snippets of information, or something would appear in the music press that they'd been seen together or something was happening. But it wasn't, I remember being shocked suddenly seeing on the front pages of the Sunday supplements pictures of three of them together once we get towards the end of the project. And that's when it really started to impact.
Yeah. All the stuff that Jeff says he had to do with the Free as a Bird tape, which was, you know, that the timing was all over the place and there was kind of some tonal issues. You could fix those things on your phone now at the click of a button. You quantize, you auto-tune, you do all that kind of stuff. So, but Jeff, you know, the again, it's more of this kind of legend building. You know, Jeff was chosen because he was the guy with the technical know-how. It wasn't just because he was George's mate. And then poor George Martin, you know, there's like another legend made up about him being kicked to one side.
Yes. So again, this is Paul putting out the official word, is that George Martin didn't want to do this because his hearing was going. And he said, you know, he's a sensible guy. And he said, look, Paul, I like to do a proper job. And if I can't, my hearing's not up to it, I'll just take a back seat. But that, again, that doesn't have the ring of truth either, because, you know, he is involved in producing the music from the vaults and splicing together those various takes. He goes on to work on other projects. He works with Giles on the Love album in 2006. So, again, this is clearly the cover story for George Harrison putting his foot down and saying, this has got to be Jeff.
And so there's a couple of scattered days of work on Free as a Bird, and it seems that 94 is mainly Free as a Bird initially. Yeah. That, you know, we're not really sure how many days exactly there are, but it's in February and maybe into March. 94 is the first run of recording sessions on that. And it's all in Paul's Sussex Hog Hill recording studio. And it's interesting. I mean, you know, this... I remember at the time it's kind of been told us, can you believe it that, you know, they've taken this tape of John Lennon and they've recorded three guys on it? I'm like, well, that's kind of been happening forever. It happened Buddy Holly after he died, you know?
Yeah, Jimi Hendrix in the 70s, people embellishing tapes. Absolutely. Yeah.
And even at the time, you know, I remember in, you know, in the early 90s, there was a Thin Lizzy song, Dedication, that came out where they got the members of Thin Lizzy to play over a Phil Lynott demo or backing tape. And even when Anthology came out, they were fighting with Queen, who were putting out their Made in Heaven Freddie Mercury album, which was made up from the same kind of tapes.
The other thing that I wasn't aware of until the Elton John autobiography came out, he has a little section in there where he says Yoko approached him with John's demos and said, you know, could you finish these? And he said no. You know, he didn't want to do it. He felt it was sort of either inappropriate or he didn't want to do it. And he sort of thinks, oh, well, Yoko was maybe a bit offended by this. So that seems to predate.
Yeah.
But the idea is not a new idea.
And this is June the 23rd, 1994, and they go to Fire Park. And this is my favorite thing, because this is the footage that we have in Anthology of the three of them knocking around George's house.
Yes.
And so I wonder, although Doggett says it's an apology, they did have a film crew there. So there must have been something planned. Or was there a film crew recording now and then? I don't know.
I think they're probably a film crew. Yeah. Permanently, you know, circling them.
Yeah, you do see in the Real Love video that they've got video cameras.
Yes.
I would love to get that footage. Ringo, in particular, seems to be fond of the old Video 8 video camera.
Well, he's the photographer in the band.
He is.
You know, he's always recording, taking snaps and things.
But so, what must be on those tapes? My goodness, I'd love to see all of that. But yeah, the 23rd of June is... So, and a lot of it features as DVD extras as well on the DVD of the eventual release of Anthology. And it's... fascinating. The moment in Anthology where the three of them are together is just, you can cut the, I feel you can cut the tension, even though there's nothing actually objectively tense happening, but it just doesn't feel natural.
No, because they're all playing a part. And I mean, I would say this, wouldn't I? But Paul is playing the part. You know, Paul is being Paul.
Yeah.
And you can see this.
Do this, like, this is totally normal.
this is just, you know, I mean, there's a scene earlier where they're arriving at his studio and George gets out of this amazing car.
Yeah. And that's not on the DVD, but it's on YouTube.
And Paul is going, oh, lovely motor. And you can just feel, even as George has his back to the camera, the sort of disdain for this is, and he's probably thinking, this is a multi-million pound.
It's some kind of fancy McLaren. I think it's a one-of-a-kind McLaren that they get out of. And it's hugely ostentatious. And it's a really funny clip because Paul obviously is just one of these people who couldn't care less about what kind of car it is. Just does not care at all. But is trying to say, oh, it's a lovely motor. and yet we're all wondering why George is bankrupt. You know, the mind boggles.
It was an investment. It was an investment.
But the footage that I remember is it is when they're all sitting around playing the ukuleles and singing Ain't She Sweet. They're phenomenally fast. It's amazing how they slip into, obviously they're professional musicians, but they do harmonize. And we've got the footage of them, you know, playing Blue Moon of Kentucky and a few of those things
thinking of linking.
Yeah. And, you know, they do kind of slip into that.
You see Paul, you know, they do Thinking of Linking and they do Raunchy.
Yeah.
And then Paul says, you know, shall we do one more? And George is kind of getting off the stool. He's dead. You know, can we do one more? Can we do more?
Yeah.
Blue Moon of Kentucky, and George is going, a short version. You know, and it's like the day is over. It's time to go.
But the reality is, you know, Paul also just loves music. He would happily sit there, play. You know the story about George Martin trying to leave a party. And Paul just, there's a story, I forget where I heard it, but it's like Paul is at this party and he just keeps playing kind of songs. And George Martin's like, yeah, I have to go. But Paul just likes playing stuff on the piano and go, hey, no, what about this one? And they just kind of.
But that is the sense that you get, that Paul does not want that day to end.
Yeah.
You know, this is his ultimate fantasy. He's sitting in with a guitar, with George. Ringo was behind the drum kit, and there it's just they're doing what they did back in 58 59,
but they
16.
Do but I do think Paul wishes, you know, like, you know, why is George so mean?
I think it's terrible that Paul doesn't realize why that exists, why that atmosphere exists, and why the relationships are the way they are.
Yeah, but the touching bit, and I think we've talked about it before, is right at the end of that clip, is when, you know, they're saying, well, we had a great day here, and Ringo says, I really love hanging out with you guys.
Yeah.
And it's so disarming to Paul and George, and Paul just kind of puts his hand on his shoulder, and it's just...
Because they both love Ringo.
They both love Ringo, yeah.
They both love Ringo, and yeah.
Yeah, and if that's sometimes having a Ringo in your life is all you need. So that happens in June 94, and obviously in the background, this thing is being edited together and being put together. As far as we know, most of the other interviews and everything are done, but we don't, it's going to be the following year before we start looking at edits and all the rest. But as 94 plays out, what's interesting is another Apple-sanctioned EMI Beatles record hits the record stands. Another one of these kind of proof of concept of catalog marketing.
Yes.
This time it is new and unreleased material. And so on the 20th of November, 94, exactly 1 year before Anthology, Live at the BBC comes out.
Yeah.
And I remember this was a big deal.
This was a huge deal. This was a huge deal because this was, as you say, this was new material. This was unreleased material. And these were not just BBC sessions that were songs that they appeared on albums. These were songs that you couldn't get anywhere else.
Yeah. And it's you know, Live at the BBC, and, you know, there's a podcast episode in that on its own. But yeah, it's 52 tracks. It was a double CD, came out at the end of November 94 in the UK, started December in the US. And it's the first way of trying to, you know, it's interesting that this was deemed to be worthy of a standalone release when they could have rolled some of this stuff into an anthology, but yes, they actually kind of pushed to get it out a year before Anthology, that it's its own thing.
Yes. Now, the story that I've heard is that Ringo was one of the prime movers behind this, because somebody stopped him and asked him, this is when he was still signing autographs, asked him to autograph a copy of a CD collection called the Complete BBC Sessions that came out on a bootleg label, Great Dane. This is a thing I would like, if anybody has it, would like to send it to me, I'd give it a good home. This supposedly was a rather sort of exquisitely put together box of every single session. And Ringo was asked to sign it. And he sort of thought, okay, well, that's what people are buying, this stuff. And that's where the idea originated, that he was saying, look, people, you know, the Beatles are very conscious of other people making money off the back of things that they did. So I think that's the sort of origin. Yeah. Myth. Maybe it's a myth.
I think Live at the BBC is an essential purchase. There's 30 songs on there that you just can't get anywhere else, like unique songs. And there's, you know, the other 22 tracks on the album are versions of tracks that we know. But this is the first true, new, official, unreleased Beatles material since 1977, when Live at the Hollywood Bowl came out.
Yeah.
So it is a big deal.
And it gets the number one in the UK, number three in America,
yeah.
8 million copies sold in the first year. So, and what you have to remember is these are largely mono recordings made from BBC studios for the radio broadcast decades before, and it's a number one
but
album.
It is worth pointing out, you know, that all of this stuff happens in sort of a pre-internet time, you know, when you think about it, because, you know, the timing of this is perfect. You know, there's no, you know, there's no other way to get this material apart from expensive CD bootlegs. There's no YouTube. So all this stuff is kind of new. So 94 rolls into 1995. And 1995, Apple discloses a very large profit in its tax return in January 1995.
$18.5 million.
So, you know,
Tidy
sum. They're doing okay. This is pre-anthology. They haven't done any anthology notes yet. And then there's a load of recording sessions that kind of happen. And so there may or may not have been some work done the year before, but February 95 is kind of the core of the work on Real Love. And I think the footage from the video comes from February 95, if we're trying to guess based on facial hair and all the rest. They're definitely, you know, they're obviously miming to sections of Real Love in that. And so that's the start of February, but there's a couple of other scattered sessions that happen in the springtime as well. But there's another interesting recording session that happens around that time as well.
Yes, so this is, again, at Paul's house where Yoko is visiting.
So we've had all the different kind of combinations. We've had Paul and Yoko in New York and at the Dakota, and now we've got Paul and Yoko hanging out in Sussex at Hog Hill Studios, making a recording a song. And this is obviously a song that Paul's knocked off on his lunch break, is it?
Yes. Well, this is I've never understood. There's so many questions. why is Yoko and Sean are visiting? Why are Yoko and Sean visiting? I like to think she thought maybe she was going to be invited to contribute to Real Love or something.
Okay.
But, you know, Paul is just showing around the studio, and he says, "Hey, we should record a song." And Yoko, before Paul can dig out the
Blue
Moon
of Kentucky.
Blue Moon of Kentucky. She says, "You know, I've got this catchy number. Hiroshima sky is always blue."
Yeah.
And off they go.
And so we think this is probably March 95, although some people think it's January 95.
Yeah.
And Paul and Yoko and their respective families, Sean and Paul's kids and Linda, they record this song in Paul's studio, and it comes out later in the year. And I'm sure Paul has an eye on optics, posterity again, what it means, you know, not wanting to add to the sum of goodwill that's in this project. I know we're kind of joking about it a lot in this episode, but I you know, he is doing the best he can.
Yes, I mean, I'm very prepared to give Paul credit for this. I mean, I think this seems to me to indicate that he is genuinely trying to build bridges. You know, he's building on that very awkward hug at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, but this seems a very genuine attempt to build a relationship with Yoko and with Sean. You know, this is not known about at the time, and it's much later in the year. It's sort of in August before this actually leaks out, and the song. I don't know. You can get a version of this. There's a short 4-minute version. There's the full 7-minute version. They're both available on YouTube. It's it's clearly a Yoko track. You know, it's
nothing
not
wrong with that.
Nothing wrong with that. It's not a Paul McCartney track. And I think supposedly, from what I read, I don't have a copy of this, but it gets an official release. So in 2011. Yoko had an art exhibition at the Hiroshima City Museum of Contemporary Arts. If you went to the gift shop, you could buy a hardback book, and you got the CD. And I always thought this song was just an in-studio improvisation.
Right.
But it does seem to be something that Yoko had in her mind, and she said, "Oh, we could do this." And so she gets sole credit.
Fair enough.
And all the royalties, which I imagine are substantial.
Substantial royalties. And the other thing that happens in March is Baby It's You comes out as a single in the UK and goes top 10 from the BBC, Live the BBC album. And I certainly remember being in London in March 1995 and seeing posters for that single everywhere, all over the tube. That was a really big push. And we also think there's more Treacle sessions than in March, possibly on Now and Then. Possibly on this song that we may or may not exist, All for Love. What's the story of that?
Well, this is, again, different reports of George and Paul writing a song together called All for Love, which doesn't sound very promising, I have to say. But
well, you know, there's a terrible song. Do you remember that terrible song, All for Love, by Sting, Bryan Adams and Rod Stewart?
Perhaps it's that one.
That song. Anyway, go on.
but so again, supposedly this session just grinds on. It doesn't go anywhere. It doesn't come to anything. George is losing interest, and this is potentially, I suppose, going to be the third single. You know, if Now and Then has been abandoned, then this is the only possible contender for a third single, and it just goes nowhere.
Yeah.
But one day, Paul and Jeff will,
or just Jeff on his own,
or just Jeff will finish it off. Yeah.
Yes, there are truths that will come out someday, I suppose. But what's happening as spring goes into summer 95 is that the anthology, you know, starts to get finalized. But at the same time, you know, when we look at this timeline towards the end of 95, it's amazing how much is still left to be done. There's an awful lot that hasn't happened yet.
Yes. I mean, if I were putting this project together, you know, whenever we do the 8-hour documentary about our podcast,
yes,
we will have that finished before I take it out to the market.
We record them years in advance and we whittle them down from an 8-hour rough take.
We've got all those there. But in May, they are sort of putting this out for auction, effectively. They're looking for bids. We've got this TV show. Presumably people can see the sort of early drafts and rushes of this. But there is still so much more to do because they want this out on the TV by the end of the year.
Yeah. And so there is a bidding war. And in the UK, apparently, you know, they're looking for 6 million. ITV bid 5 million to show it in the UK. And Channel 4 drop out at 4.5 million.
I remember being very disappointed that, you know, it was going to be an ITV.
It felt like a BBC thing.
It felt like it should be a BBC thing.
Yeah, well, it was on RTE, obviously, in Ireland, and it was on ABC in the US. And ABC announced that they have the rights a few days later on the 10th of May. What's interesting is the title isn't given when it's announced. They just sort of say we have this Beatles thing.
So, I mean, George at this stage still wants it to be called The Beatles by The Beatles.
Yes.
It's nothing much catchy about that. And again, if you think about anthology, it's not an anthology.
No, it's really a terrible name.
It's a terrible name. Yeah. And again, it's just another product of this compromise, this negotiation, this Cold War detente where they're working something out. It's not...
Like The Beatles by The Beatles isn't the worst title in the world. I mean, the reality is The Long and Winding Road is a good title, you know, possibly.
Well, you would say that. But it's such a loaded... it's a Paul song.
Yes.
And, you know, almost effectively, it's like a solo song by Paul. Secondly, for Paul, presumably it's reclaiming that from Spectre and the orchestra and the choir. So there's a lot of politics around that name. And I mean, he must have known from day one it was never going to be called that.
I'm trying to think, is there any other song title that would have pleased people?
Long.
it was long. So it gets announced in May. I certainly remember the single, around this time at the start of the year, February, March, the announcement that a single was coming, a reunion single was recorded, and that a reunion single is coming. Because I remember talking to people at college about it and them not being particularly interested, but me being very interested in the whole thing. But we're into May 95 and the Beatles start to see the first rough cut. And I'm wondering, is this a version of the rough cut that has circulated on bootlegs in recent years? It must be.
It must be. I mean, there is a very comprehensive DVD bootleg set with a lot of extra footage. I have to say, I have not watched that in a number of years, but it must be. So again, it seems to me that here there are shades of Magical Mystery Tour. So they're watching this. They're each giving their input. So I don't know if it's being cut and recut to the extent of Magical Mystery Tour, but essentially, you know, the production team, the director, is having to keep everyone happy.
Yes.
You know, and supposedly Paul produces very detailed typed up notes
Yep.
About what he wants. At one stage, Jeff Wanford, the director, said George had wanted him to do the entire thing in the style of Monty Python, which I think would be excellent.
Yeah. Well, it's May. The three of them are all together in May 95, and they are they're looking at the rough cuts, and that bootleg rough draft. The credit sequence is one of the most frightening things you'll ever see. It's this kind of head amalgamated. Yes. From their four faces that kind of splits into four. It's really terrible. And there's no incidental music. And there's an awful lot of talk about drugs that gets eventually whittled out and taken away. But they also go to Abbey Road, the three of them, with George Martin.
Yes. So this is late May, 22nd of May. Yeah. The three of them are there listening to various things. And at one point, they get up and go for a wander around the studio.
Yeah,
around the building, just for old time's sake.
And it's also, this stuff is, there's a film crew there. It's recorded for Anthology. Memory serves, I don't think any of that footage goes into Anthology. It goes into the DVD extras of them hanging around, and they don't even, it's really weird. They don't remember what song is on what album. You're wondering, is George kind of hamming that up a little bit?
It's like, did you play bass on that?
Well, yeah.
If I'm playing piano, who's playing?
Yeah. And it's, obviously they needed a Mark Lewisohn in the room for that.
Yeah.
But, they also apparently all go out for dinner with their wives as well. There's a story from that time about somebody in a local cafe in Camden, I think it was, where Paul, George and Ringo wander in some afternoon for coffee and sandwiches, and everyone's like, what? And again, it's a pre-internet thing. That wouldn't happen now. Like, when you think about how fast James Corden and Paul went around the world the day that happened, the fact that Paul, George and Ringo walking into a cafe in 1995 is wonderful.
A vegetarian cafe.
Presumably. I would hope so.
I mean, you would have liked to have been sitting in that cafe.
Yes, I would indeed. And so Bob Smeaton, the series director, says, he recalls watching The Rushes with George talking about the breakup and Paul saying, I didn't know you felt like that, George. Like, it's all very strange.
I think that is the most telling comment about the whole thing, that they're watching that final episode, that end sequence, 1969, 1970, and Paul is going, I never knew that. I didn't know this annoying. Yeah. And you think, this is the point, Paul.
Yeah.
You need to engage with this, and then you can work through it, and then we can get out the other side.
And there's a couple of quotes you've pulled here from Jeff Wanford, the producer, saying, it was an insane amount of hassle and pressure, the most nightmarish thing I've ever had to do in my life, a lot of mind games, and a lot of my job was to stop them talking to each other to keep them happy and not telling one of them what the other one had said.
Yes. So then you have this notion that they are then finally together watching it, and for the first time,
yes,
hearing what they have each said about particular areas, and particularly in that 1969, 1970 period, that must have been, like sitting
a minefield.
Just sitting in on someone else's therapy session.
Yeah, yeah.
And
in this notion of, the thing not being named by the time it's announced in May, it's June 1995 when they pick up the phone to Klaus Voormann and say, I suppose we should get a cover for this thing. I find it amazing that the graphic design or the organ, like, that still hadn't been considered or thought out. I guess back in the 60s, everything was, a few weeks from studio to shelves, but it just...
You get a sense that they are still working that way, that it is just, they're sort of flying by the seat of their pants slightly, and, it's the Beatles, everything will be fine.
Yeah, so Klaus Voormann is contacted in June 95 to do the cover, and, that gets completed in September. He's given access to the photo archives, and we all know the Anthology cover. It's this triptych of images where the three album covers, you can put them side by side. And I guess it is good. It does sort of, it does represent the past and them as well. It's a bit cheesy, but,
You think cheesy?
Maybe cheesy isn't the word. It's not very dramatic.
No.
It's very,
It is something I do like. I really did like the cover on the first anthology CD when
you can get lost in those covers.
Yes, because you're kind of trying to identify, you know, would it have worked better if they'd just taken the actual photographs rather than have it painted? It's all painted. That was the aspect I didn't like, but I did like the sort of collage effect.
I think it has aged well. I don't think it's...
I think so. And one of the things, for years, I just assumed this was Klaus Voormann had done this from start to finish.
No, but he didn't.
Only comparatively recently that I learned that he sort of designed it, sketched it out, and then someone else actually...
Alphonse Kiefer.
Yes.
Did the painting itself.
Well-known.
Well-known Alphonse. I've got a couple of Kiefers up on my wall.
Well, there you go. He's described as an ultra-realistic painter. So he actually did this. And there are two, you'll know this, there are...
Well, I you know what? I knew about one of them, but the other one you told me about, I didn't know about.
These are two little kind of...
Easter eggs, I guess.
Yeah. So go ahead.
I always knew that Klaus Voormann is hiding on the cover of Anthology because Klaus Voormann is hiding on the cover of Revolver.
Yes.
And so if you look at the cover of Revolver where he's signed his name, his picture is in the montage.
Yeah.
And the bit of Revolver that's reproduced on the cover of Anthology is the bit of the montage with him in it, but the picture is updated for him in the 90s.
Yes.
So
aged himself.
He has aged himself, but it means that he is the only person not in the Beatles to appear on two Beatles album covers, basically.
Yes.
And who's still alive and with us. But what I didn't realize was that Alphonse Kiefer is on the cover.
Yes.
So should we tell people where he's hiding?
Well, generically tell them he is hiding in the cover of Sgt. Pepper.
Yes.
So the painting of the Sgt. Pepper cover has been altered, and one of the original faces there, one of the original characters, has disappeared and been replaced. So we'll just let people tweet or
have a little look and see where he's there.
Let us know on Facebook.
And speaking of characters being replaced, poor Pete Best, eh?
Yeah, poor Pete. This is, again, there's always just something not quite peace and love about each Beatles project, and this is, I think, poor Pete Best.
So Pete Best is kind of ripped from his picture on the cover of Anthology 1. So things are all last minute. That picture, that painting, that cover isn't finished until September 95. And in September 95, everything starts to come together. And one thing that happens in September 95, a little side avenue, which I might talk about, is the Help album. Not the Beatles Help album, but an album called Help by Warchild. And this is an interesting album, and it's a good signifier of what was happening culturally at the time, because Britpop was insanely popular. And, we could have a whole podcast series on the history of Britpop. You know, did it start with Suede's debut single? I'd like to think so.
I think so.
In 1995, this concept of Britpop, and certainly in the UK and Ireland, was huge. And in August 1995, you know, the sort of what's often reported as the pinnacle was the Oasis versus Blur battle for number one. But on the 4th of September 1995, a charity album was recorded called Help for the charity War Child, and it was put together by Andy McDonald from Go Records, and it was inspired by John Lennon's Instant Karma, because John Lennon said he wanted records to be like newspapers and they should be recorded in a day and put out the next day, and you know that's how you do it. So he had this idea the previous weekend that we should record an album in a day, and he got all the big wigs of Britpop to appear and turn up onto this album. So you have, you know, people like Suede and the KLF got back together, and Stone Roses are on it, and Manic Street Preachers, and that's the first appearance of the song Lucky by Radiohead is on this album before it goes off to be on OK Computer. But the main thing that happens is a supergroup goes to Abbey Road to record Come Together, and who turns up?
Paul
turns up. So this is a group, the Smoke and Mojo Filters, which is Paul Weller, Noel Gallagher, Steve Craddock, Steve White, Carlin Anderson, and Paul McCartney turns up, and they record, and it's filmed, a cover of Come Together. And this album is recorded on the 4th of September 95, and it's put out on the 9th of September 95. So you know, part of the Beatles anthology story says that, you know, it happened at a time when the Beatles stock was high with the contemporary bands of the time. And I would certainly say on this side of the Atlantic, yeah, that was very true. Oasis were putting out their second album in the autumn of 95, What's the Story, Morning Glory, which was an immensely successful album.
Yeah, you know? huge album.
And they were putting out the single Wonderwall, which is based on a George Harrison soundtrack. Hugely successful song. You know, this was peak Britpop, peak Beatles cool. So yeah, for the anthology to be coming in on a wave of that, and for Paul to sort of come in as this elder statesman, I recently looked up the ages they were at the time. You know, I think, you know, Paul is what, only 53 at the time of that recording?
A young man.
And I think Weller's in his 60s now. But, you know, that was a nice, it's a nice symbolic thing. But it just goes to show that, you know, there's a version of Paul that gets on with other musicians and that turns up and does the job. But, you know, when it's back to being the Threetles, it's a whole different thing.
Yes. And again, you know, he's got to have had in his mind, we've got this project.
Yeah.
You know, Paul, whatever else, he's good at the PR. He's got a very keen commercial sense. You know, George and Ringo are not interested in modern music.
No.
At all. George famously has a spat with Liam Gallagher,
yeah.
You know, says, oh yeah, you know, I quite like the guitar player, but I don't like the singer, you know, the stupid one. So, you know, George has no interest in modern music and certainly no interest in playing the role of elder statesman.
Yes. But that week of September 95, in the middle of that, there's the MPL Buddy Holly party. And we know, because Mark Lewison, name drop, said it on our episode, that he was involved in the anthology project, and he remembers being at that party, and Paul was kind of quite shook at the politics and what was going on.
Yes, but Mark described being at the Buddy Holly party that Paul at that stage held every year. Paul had just come, I think, from that session the day before, from watching the Rushes, and I'm wondering, is that maybe where that Bob Smeaton comment comes from about, you know, I didn't know you felt that way.
Yeah.
And he's clearly very upset or very emotionally charged as a result of that. And he's holding forth to the production team, and Mark Lewison happens to be there at the time. So clearly this is some kind of cathartic point for Paul in all of this. And, you know, people can go back and listen to the Lewison episode.
Yeah, where he talks about that. It's very, very illuminating. But then it becomes real. The 11th of September 1995 is when the official press release comes out. Just when you thought you'd heard it all, Capitol Records releases, announces the Beatles Anthology 1 track listing. And so this is kind of, I think the initial announcement is on the 11th of September. And I think the track listing comes out in full in October.
Yeah.
For what's coming out. And this thing now finally has a name. The Free as a Bird has a date.
Yeah.
And I remember 1995 me was getting more excited as the weeks go by, that for the first time in my life, I would experience
a new
Beatles single.
Yeah.
But it becomes real. And this is where the kind of the publicity machine kind of starts to kick into overdrive.
Yes, this is where the pace starts to pick up,
yeah.
And there is a sense of a sort of a rush towards the finishing line.
Yes,
and one of the things, and this is really one of the first things that I recall, is this photograph appearing of the three Beatles.
Now I don't remember this at the time, but this was on the 5th of October 95. This is on the cover of The Sun.
Yeah.
And this was kind of a stolen photo or a sneaky photo?
This was just an unofficial snap that the Apple staff photographer took, and then he sold it to The Sun for £100,000.
And I think the headline was like, got back or something like that.
Yeah.
And it's the three of them in a sneaky photo, but it is the three of them.
Yeah.
The official photographer, though, was
Linda.
Linda got, and she got a paid a retainer or got paid per image the official.
She got £2,000 per photograph. It's good work if you can get it.
Yeah, she must have known someone. So the thing is, if you look at any of the official photos of Paul, George and Ringo from 95, Linda took them.
You have to pay her £2,000.
I have to pay. If I look at them, I have to pay her £2,000.
The photograph that I remember, and it was on the front cover of a Sunday paper supplement.
Yes.
It is the three of them standing under a tree, and there's a white Peacock.
Oh, yes, yes.
Walks into the shot.
Yes.
And that allowed Paul to sort of say, oh, that was John was there.
Yes. He's so good at that kind of thing, isn't he? Yeah, he's just so good.
He's natural.
And so then we kind of ratchet towards the final date itself. My own personal recollection the first time was the cover of Q magazine,
yes,
which had the three of them together. And I remember walking into a shop and seeing that cover again, pre-internet times, you'd know the way of seeing it. And I still have it on my shelves inside, you know, calm down. And it was a brilliant cover.
Yeah.
Absolutely fantastic article, really exciting and expansive. Mojo then came out with a set of covers, no contemporary pictures, but a very deep, one of the best in-depth looks at the anthology. If you can find a 95 copy of the Beatles anthology edition of Mojo, absolutely fantastic. So this becomes a real thing. And eventually, alongside all this, there's the work on the Free as a Bird video.
Yes. And again, this is the point that you were saying. We're very late in the day.
Yeah.
So according to the research that we've done, 23rd of October.
They start making that video.
They start making the video. And it's a guy called Joe Pitka, mm-hmm. who's an American film commercial director, had worked with Michael Jackson on Heal the World. There's going to be some irony there that he was Michael Jackson's. But anyway.
Well, you know, Michael Jackson kept Free as a Bird off number one.
Yes.
That annoys me. And I know there's more important things in the world that should annoy me. That annoys me.
You think if you're annoyed, do you think how Paul felt?
Paul must have been very annoyed. But the mistake was, and we're going slightly off-piste here, was releasing the single after the album.
They should have done what they always did in the 60s and put it out as a standalone single.
Or just put it out beforehand. Give it at least a week's head start.
But why put it on the album? It doesn't fit. It doesn't work. I mean, I bought the first ever copy of Anthology 1 sold in Northern Ireland. That's my claim to fame.
Very good.
I remember standing in R Price watching them unbox it. I took a day off work just to listen to it. And it was a little disappointing.
Well, I remember being in a lecture on the day it came out and one of my lecturers saying, there's a new Beatles song and album out today and really you should all go off and get it. And I remember thinking, he's a good lecturer. I like him.
But Free as a Bird, it should have been, I think it should have been a standalone single because that's the way they did things in the 60s and it doesn't fit. It's a modern recording sort of shoehorned into an archive piece.
Yeah, well, what was impressive at the time is how locked down it was and how it didn't get heard until the embargo lifted. Now, George apparently played it early to Damon Hill, his racing buddy.
Because again, if you have an absolute strict embargo and this big important project, then George is going to break that embargo.
Basically, you just don't tell George what to do.
You really have that sense that that's the case.
You know,
if we look at that idea that he wanted this to be like Monty Python, there is this kind of irreverence about it.
Yes.
There is this idea, well, if you tell me how to do something, I'll do it the different way. Jeff Wanfer says specifically, George is the one that opened up about everything, and that did not play well, particularly with Yoko. So you get the sense he must have started unpacking all that baggage.
Yes.
With his relationship with John.
But again, leaving stuff to the last minute, there are still some bits and pieces of outstanding EMI Apple litigation. And so it's still into November at the 11th hour that there's stuff being signed off on the week before the music comes out. So they're obviously printing it. It's obviously at the presses and in the trucks on the way to the stores.
Yeah, this is how lawyers work. You leave everything to the last minute and then sign everything on the back of an envelope.
It's memories of them signing at the last minute before Abbey Road comes out in September 69. And I think EMI were thinking that it would be the first of a suite of things like Esher demos and Let It Be and all the rest, which we're still sort of parsing out 25 years later.
Yes. So, I mean, if you think about it, they had the Red, the Blue album, they'd had the BBC, there was still more BBC stuff in the vaults.
Yep.
They were looking down the road to the Esher demos. Let It Be has been talked about, as being on the cusp of release.
Yep.
Every few years, that was a rumor that was coming out. So EMI were really staking everything on Apple.
Yes.
You know, pulling out these big money spinning projects.
And it's only on the 18th of November that Neil Aspinall and Derek Taylor sign off on the Free as a Bird video, which is hilarious.
Crazy.
And the song finally gets its debut airing on BBC Radio 1 at 4:07 a.m. on the 20th of November. That's when they play Free as a Bird. And I think it was that early because it was happening in the
US, in the States. Yeah. I did not sit up or get up.
Well, I remember there was a TV special on that night where people reminisced about on ITV for half an hour about how they love the Beatles, and it was
Cilla Black and the like,
all the big stars,
and Jimmy Starbuck.
The trail was at the end of this half hour. We will show you the new video. So that's when I first saw it.
Me too.
And heard it, and I remember watching it going, I like it, I think. What was that? What's happened? I mean, you know, there's always disappointment. I always knew that there would come a point where I would hear it, and then the time would pass, and there's nothing you can do about that. It's like many good things in life. But again, you know, on the 20th of November, there's a press conference, and I think, did they expect the Beatles to turn up?
I mean, there seems genuinely to have been this naive expectation that the three of them would be there, you know. I mean, which again, it perhaps says more about the media and what people wanted it to be.
Yes.
You know, I mean, as someone that had lived through the 70s and that the reunion rumors and then 1980, et cetera, et cetera, I genuinely just always believed that if they got back together again, everything would be all right.
Yes.
Everything would, the sun would come out, everything would be fine. And I think there was clearly that anticipation, that element of that they're going to turn up, they're going to be there. And it didn't follow the script.
And who they did, the people the press did meet were George Martin, Derek Taylor, and Jeff Lynne.
Well, Jeff was there. So, I mean, what more did the press want?
I mean, you know, it's like having all the Beatles in one person.
Yeah.
And when Derek Taylor was asked, where are the Beatles? Derek says,
everywhere else but here.
Isn't, how true is that? And then the following, Derek was a legend. And then following that, the 21st of November, that is Anthology Day. We get the TV show, we get the albums, and all that stuff gets released.
Yeah.
But I think you're right. You know, there is this notion that, well, if we can just get them back together, they'll realize they love each other as much as we love them, and something new will bloom. And that's not really the legacy, or not what happened next.
No. It is that sort of slight disappointment that you know, you're anticipating something, or you and it's almost as if the world made a fool of itself and then woke up the next day and realized, oh well, perhaps that was a bit embarrassing that we got a bit worked up about that. So it sort of fizzles out slightly. I mean, I remember, you know, we'll not talk about the content of the TV show, but it, you know, the audience numbers started to decline. It the last episode in the UK was shown around Christmas time, and it became a bit of a non-event, and then it just sort of fizzled out. And then in March 96, Anthology 2 comes out. There's a bit of interest around that. And Anthology 3, it comes out in October of 96. And it ceased to be a news event.
Yeah.
There was all of this anticipation. Could never hope to live up to the hype. And I suppose in a way, that's what certainly what John and George, it's really what all of them had been saying all the way through the 70s. You know, it we can't be what you want us to be.
Yeah.
You know?
And so, you know, they always prided themselves on telling the truth, you could say, and they were right all along. But maybe the after effects and the tale of the anthology is what we're going to talk to next, because we've said that there'd be a couple of these episodes scattered throughout 2020, the 25th anniversary of the anthology, the silver anniversary. So we're going to leave that to another day. You know, where did the anthology leave us once the circus had left town, so to speak?
Nicely done.
Thank you very much. So we hope you've enjoyed that. I mean, there's more to this anthology story than meets the eye, and it's amazing how prickly and difficult it is. And congratulations to the people who managed to get Paul, George, and Ringo to behave long enough to get it to air. I'm certainly glad that it exists, but we will talk about that another day. We remain available on all the usual places. We're on Twitter @BeatlesPod. We've a Facebook group. group. Stephen can let you in there. We thank you for subscribing wherever you subscribe. If you want to leave some nice reviews, we're always appreciative of that. But for the next time, until the next time, I'm Jason Carty.
I'm Stephen Cockcroft.
And this has been Nothing Is Real. We'll see you soon. Thanks. Nothing Is Real is powered by Acast.